You're listening to Clinical Conversations, a Journal Watch podcast. It's for the week ending October 23rd, and it's podcast number 62. Joe Elia here. This time, we talk with Dr. Jane Kim about her work on the cost-effectiveness of using HPV vaccine in older women. First, this review of the week's principal clinical news stories. First off, national data from a quality improvement program show that only about a third of eligible heart failure patients are receiving prescriptions for aldosterone antagonists at discharge. The drugs are contraindicated in some patients, and the good news is that among those patients, the rate of inappropriate usage is low. Next, phosphodiesterase 5 inhibitors should be prescribed to men seeking treatment for erectile dysfunction, according to American College of Physicians guidelines just issued in the Annals of Internal Medicine. The guidelines makers found insufficient evidence to recommend for or against routine hormonal testing or hormonal therapy in this condition. And next, there's been a recall of injectable ketorolac. The manufacturer says that crystallization has been seen in 1 and 2 milliliter single-dose vials. The crystals could lead to obstruction of blood vessels and its consequences. Finally, children with chronic kidney disease, especially those with renal hypoplasia dysplasia, benefit from intensive blood pressure control, according to a New England Journal of Medicine study. About 400 children were already receiving high doses of the ACE inhibitor ramipril, and half were randomized to further treatment with non-renin-angiotensin active drugs to lower their blood pressures to under 50% of the normal range. The other children were kept within the upper 50% of normal. After 5 years, intensive therapy apparently delayed progression of kidney disease. Now, on to the interview. You're listening to Clinical Conversations. Earlier this week, the Annals of Internal Medicine published a study on the cost-effectiveness of adding HPV vaccination to cervical screening in U.S. women over age 30. The researchers used epidemiologic and cancer registry data to run simulation models on the likely outcome. They assumed that the women continued to undergo annual or biennial screening, and they found that, by and large, the benefits of adding vaccination weren't worth the cost. Here to talk about those results is Dr. Jane Kim, an assistant professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Harvard School of Public Health. Welcome, Dr. Kim.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you why you studied the question. Is there talk of vaccinating women in their 30s and later against HPV?
Sure. So the current recommendation is to vaccinate pre-adolescent girls and women up to the age of 26. And the vaccine trials have recently been reporting information about the vaccine's safety and efficacy against HPV-related conditions in women up to the age of 45. So it is anticipated that the FDA may at some point be considering whether or not to approve the vaccine up to the age of 45, and then subsequent to that, whether or not it should be recommended for routine use in women up to the age of 45.
So they'll be certainly reading your study.
I hope so.
How did you go about doing the research, and generally, what'd you find?
Sure. So we used a decision analytic technique of mathematical modeling. Because the benefits of an HPV vaccine and even cervical cancer screening in women is hard to predict in clinical studies because of the long natural course of cervical infection, cervical disease, and then cancer, we use mathematical models to simulate the disease in the population. And to do that, we synthesized evidence and data from epidemiological studies and what we know about the population and how the disease kind of progresses in the population, and then use that to evaluate the health benefits as well as the costs associated with different interventions. Mm-hmm. And in our particular analysis, we evaluated HPV vaccination among women who are getting cervical cancer screening in the United States. Our general findings extend our previous findings that as women are older, as we vaccinate older women, the cost effectiveness of HPV vaccination in women starts to diminish with age. And that was basically what we found in this analysis, that really vaccinated women over the age of 30 is not very cost effective, which means that the interventions do not provide good value for the money that's invested.
You're right that the average lifetime risk for U.S. women is less than 1%.
That's right.
And so is it that vaccination in women is less cost effective because of the effectiveness of the screening program?
It's partly because of the screening program. I mean, I think you have the right idea in that we're starting with a very low baseline risk mm-hmm. for cervical cancer in the U.S. population, and that is largely attributable to successful screening and aggressive screening in the United States. So adding the HPV vaccine, which is, you know, a particularly expensive vaccine, onto the screening program, it adds a little bit of benefit, but for the cost, we found that it's just not a very good investment.
If the vaccine, say, cost a tenth of what you think that it would cost, or you know that it does cost, that changes the results, doesn't it?
It does. We, in some of our explorations of, you know, the impact of some of the vaccine properties, and when we changed the cost of the vaccine to, I think it was, for the three doses, it was $250, mm-hmm. so that's a pretty substantial decrease in cost, that we were able to get to a scenario where the cost-effectiveness ratio would fall below $100,000 per quality-adjusted life year, mm-hmm. which we use as an informal benchmark for something that we consider good value.
You mentioned the quality-adjusted life year. Let me ask you, in the shop there, do you call them quality-adjusted life years or do you call them qualies?
We call them qualies.
Okay. All right. So yeah. So let's call them qualies here.
Sure.
So the cost is, as the women got older in your model, the cost per quality was raised up above $200,000, in the $200,000 to $400,000 range, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
In things like knee replacements, the cost per quality there is about $20,000, I think.
Right.
So there's a big difference, but a knee replacement isn't a life-saving therapy. But when you calculated the added life as a result of vaccination among the people who received the vaccination, I think did you calculate that they were only gaining like 2 days of quality adjusted life?
That's right. So our we found that when we add vaccination to women who are currently screened according to current U.S. screening guidelines, that the gain in quality adjusted life year is really on the order of a day or maybe 2 days. And that's partly explainable because we're looking at the benefits and estimating the benefits to an average woman in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So really what those quality gains translate to are really actually pretty substantial benefits for the small proportion of women who may develop cervical cancer.
Right. So
and
who,
really no benefit to the rest of the women in the population.
Right. So
when you average that out, it becomes small.
All right. So you're averaging out that benefit over the entire cohort of vaccinated women.
Exactly.
In that group.
Exactly.
I see. So yeah, when you look at it, of course, for the, you know, 2,000 or so women who would benefit from it, the rest of the population is paying a steep economic price, which I guess in these times is something that people are going to take into account.
That's right. The U.S. does still continue to observe, I think, over 11,000 incident cases per year and over 3,000 deaths per year attributable to cervical cancer. So it by no means is not a priority, but the question is whether or not, you know, this is really the place where we should be investing our dollars. And what we hypothesize is perhaps we can get more bang for the buck by, possibly trying to reach the unscreened women who are really the ones at the highest risk for developing cervical cancer.
How might clinicians use your findings in their daily practice now?
So, we wanted to emphasize that the analysis is really conducted from a public health perspective. So, we are intending to use the results to inform guidelines for whether or not an average U.S. woman over the age of 30 should get vaccinated. That by no means insinuates that the vaccine can't be beneficial to particular women. I think the difficulty is that the vaccine is not therapeutic. And so for women who have had exposure to the vaccine types, the efficacy will be quite low. Because we don't have any clinical tests used in practice currently to identify definitively whether or not a woman has had a prior exposure to one of the vaccine types, it's really hard to gauge whether or not a woman sitting in a doctor's office will stand to benefit from the vaccine. So there could be questions, and doctors could ask for information on sexual practice. The number of lifetime sexual partners has been found to be a strong predictor of HPV infection or exposure to HPV infection. So there, I think, needs to be a conversation between the woman and the healthcare provider as to whether or not this vaccine could be beneficial for them.
Because, as you say in the paper, there are some people who begin sexual activity later in life who would benefit from a vaccination.
That's right. So, the majority of the population is already sexually active by the time they're 30.
Mm.
But there are obviously cases where women have not been sexually active, so their risk of prior HPV exposure is quite low, but who then become sexually active and they can face a future risk of HPV infection, in which case the vaccine could be very beneficial for them.
Okay. It sounds like the advice then is to, if somebody comes in asking for this, to have the conversation with them about their history and then maybe taking a peek at your data to have a conversation about whether, in fact, it's going to be worth their while to...
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Just to get an assessment of, their risk profile for HPV and cervical cancer.
All right. Well, Dr. Kim, I want to thank you again for talking with me today about this.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
You can reach Clinical Conversations at 1-617-440-4374, or you can write to me, jelia@nejm.org. Earlier podcasts are all available at podcasts.jwatch.org, where links for all stories can also be found. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adore Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us next time. Enough said.